right now. Want to hop into the time machine, if we can, and go back 35 years. The fall of 1982, a couple of remarkable television shows that would go on to achieve iconic status made their debuts. One in September and one in October, and here to talk with us about those shows, it's our friend, author, and critic, Colin Fleming. Colin, good afternoon.
Hey, how are you, sir?
Great. Welcome back. Good to have you with us to talk about two of the best shows for my money of all time, and how crazy that both of them debuted in the same fall, although they debuted with different reactions from the audience early on.
Sure. New England was a television hotbed. Who knew, right?
In 1982,
and Cheers was the one that barely hung on, barely made it to a second season, and Newhart was the show that sort of had the red carpet rolled out for it with the original Bob Newhart show, so you knew what you were getting into there. You knew about Newhart himself from his albums going back to the early 60s. So that was kind of the tried and true. And Cheers was something a little more, it almost sounds fatuous to say experimental, but I kind of think of it that way. It's almost like a Beckett play. It's not really in a hell so much as a purgatory, like these rest stops on the side of a highway of life you're going down. And that was very different. Everything in that first season of Cheers is set in the bar. There's basically exterior establishing shots. So there you are on Beacon Street. But you go nowhere else. You go to no one's homes. You don't walk around outside. You don't go to the public garden across the street. You are in the bar.
Yeah, and that first season was remarkable. There had been workplace shows before, like Mary Tyler Moore, certainly, and you had a Dick Van Dyke show where you saw some of the workplace and some of the home life, but with Cheers, it was this strange combination of workplace for a few, but a gathering place for others. And you heard about those other characters, the wives, the other people in the lives of the characters, but you never saw them.
Right. Taxi was a little bit that way, too, like an analog for Cheers. And I always liked that offstage presence. The Frasier show would do it with the Maris character. But it's almost like Waiting for Godot, like Norm's wife. And people, as you know in life, as you go along, they might tell you what they think somebody's like, but it's probably not really what they're actually like. So you almost have characters as authors, which was something I always liked about Cheers, where people could come in and they would tell their particular narrative. But what happens, and I think this happens less now, is we become more disconnected with each other, something the internet has a hand in, is that when you're talking to people, you're getting to know yourself, in a sense, through that process of talking with them. And I think you end up giving yourself away and learning more about yourself in the process. So you see someone like Cliff, for all of his tall tales and ridiculous factoids, eventually you sort of get to the heart of that character simply through his conversational interaction with the other characters.
And there were certainly funny lines galore, but it wasn't a jokey show. It was very much a character-driven show, especially at the beginning.
Organic. And I think a lot of verbal humor originates out of kind of that pitter-patter, that back and forth. There's like a rhythmic lever in there, and they'd be people flitting in and out of lives, and they, after a turn or two, would sort of become ensconced yet throughout Cheers.
And, of course, over the course of its long run on NBC, Cheers, like a lot of shows, weathered some cast changes. And we were just talking about this with one of our other guests earlier on the program. There are Woody people. There are Coach people. For my money, what Nick Colasanto did in making such an indelible character, as good as Woody Harrelson was, for me, nothing could top what the Coach brought.
It's basically two different shows, in a sense. And Newhart would do this as well, but, like, once Diane leaves Cheers and you have the Woody character, it becomes very just sterile when you think about it. There are like sort of no emotional plots anymore. It's people hanging out in a bar, and it becomes sort of meta in many ways. Whereas I think like the first season, they didn't know what they were doing. It's more organic. It's not gesturing, pointing, referencing something else. Like you see that with the Star Wars films. When you see a Star Wars film now, to me it's almost not a film, because it's constantly nodding to other films. In Cheers in the first season, and Newhart in the first season, neither program was doing that. So you sort of became someone who pulled up the proverbial bar seat, and you're ordering your, well, Samuel Adams didn't exist at the time, but whatever they had on draft.
And we talk about them being New England-based shows. Sam Malone, Mayday Malone, had been a relief pitcher with the Boston Red Sox. His portrait, although I think it was Jim Lomborg's portrait that was hanging over the bar there, that old picture. And there were references, but they also made it universal enough that you didn't have to be a Boston person or a New England person to love the show and identify with the characters.
Sometimes I wonder if there was like a New York variant and someone like made a Thurman Munson reference. How I'd handle that, like, probably alienate me. So I was always kind of like, I was really young when it came on. I didn't see it during its original run, but like, I was sort of like your ideal demographic for that. And they'd have like a Red Sox player who was struggling come in to get advice from Sam Malone, which is kind of like coming in to get advice from like the last reliever, like the mop-up guy in the blowout game. It wasn't exactly like Lee Smith or like Dennis Eckersley closing in his prime. It was like kind of this low-grade 4-5 ERA reliever. And they talked about him, though, like he was just this unbelievably accomplished, you know, fireman type of thing. And I always got like a kick out of that. But it's almost like we all have our little fiefdoms, in a sense, where people look at us in ways that maybe they don't look at us when we go out into the rest of the world. And you kind of stop in at those rest stations to recharge your sense of self, I believe, to be better equipped to go out into the actual world and do your thing.
Cheers had an awfully long run, and I don't know that it was always as good as it was in the early seasons, but it never got bad. As long as it was on, I never felt that it wore out its welcome, and it was still a pretty high-quality show, even in its last season.
Sure, it was always peppy. You always had that like peppery dialogue too. And yeah, I think it hung in there on that level because again, you had this linchpin, this idea of like, I like these people. I am hanging out with them. And really, when you think about like any film you love, you think about like any show, when like do you most creep forward in your chair to like listen intently? It's not when things are exploding. Even on like shows like The Walking Dead, I don't care for them. But the moments that people care about the most, it's when people are talking to each other. Sometimes it's like sotto voce. Sometimes it's like shouting at each other. But you're leaning in because that goes back to sitting around a fire during like Neanderthal man days. That is what is programmed into our DNA. And that was sort of like the bedrock of Cheers.
And with Cheers, I guess ostensibly Ted Danson was the star, and yet what made it a success was that incredible ensemble of character actors that they added to as time went on with Kelsey Grammer and with others along the way. And the same was true for Newhart. He was that deadpan center of that show. But what a tremendous cast of characters, whether it was Tom Poston or the guys who played Larry, Daryl, and Daryl, Julia Duffy, Peter Scolari, really talented actors who provided a whole lot of the strength and energy of that show.
And the first season of Newhart is so different. Like, it becomes so broad in some ways later on, but it becomes surrealistic, too. It's like a show like even The Simpsons, where it's constantly referencing itself. There are these jokes, this intertextuality that Newhart himself later on is less of a character in the show and more like a one-man Greek chorus pointing out the absurdity. Like, he's constantly, it's like Oliver Hardy, right? How he looks at the camera in those films,
right?
Laurel and Hardy films, and he shrugs. He's like, do you believe this, what they have me doing now? This is absurd. And Newhart does that a lot, but in the first season, which is very theatrical, it's almost like Orson Welles could have staged this and shot this in this sort of like low-budget setup. He's in the action itself. He's not gesturing to you yet. And I think that like established sort of your loyalty towards the show, that you were going to go along with them later when they went further and further afield. It's almost like jazz. It's like you have hard bop. It's like, oh, this makes like perfect sense, and it's taking some chordal risks. And then it kind of graduates to like free jazz. And you're like, all right, John Coltrane, I'll go with you there, because you had me here. And I think Newhart is kind of like a jazzy little combo of a show in a way.
And we were talking about this yesterday as the show got closer and closer to the end. We maybe weren't aware of it at the time, but it certainly telegraphed that incredible ending to the show. And if you look back at the episodes now, you can see a lot of hints along the way. As you said, it became more meta.
Yeah, I wonder if they had that in mind or at what point, if that was always in the back pocket. Because it's one of those things that sometimes you think something up. Like when Paul McCartney thought up Yesterday, he went around for weeks humming it to people saying, I must not have written this. Someone must have come up with this by now because it's just so perfectly spot on. And that's kind of like what the ending of Newhart is like. And I think one of the key things, too, about both of these shows, and we don't talk about this a lot, is the theme music for each is so endemic of what each show does. And like it sets a tonal quality for each program that I don't think you get a lot. Like with Newhart, you think about like those strings. It's kind of like Charles Ives meets Mendelssohn via Vaughan Williams, right? Like it's the perfect I am rolling through the country in New England in autumn sort of soundtrack. And for Cheers, you have those like six opening notes, basically, then those huge ringing chords. And you get a lot of that like in Bach or an upbeat Christmas music or even like Bruce Springsteen's like Thunder Road. Think about Dakota, all of these huge ringing chords. It's very inviting. So right from the music, in a subconscious way, you're ready to go with each of these shows in the mood that they're seeking to establish.
That's a great point. And also the opening shots of both series in Newhart, the shots of New England in fall that certainly establish your locale and take you to that place. And in Cheers, I was fascinated by the fact, and I was pretty young when it came on too, that you didn't see the actors. You saw those old aged photographs that looked enough like the actors, but also established that this was Boston, this was about tradition, and that this bar has been a landmark in this area since the dawn of time.
Newhart actually cribbed their footage from outtakes of On Golden Pond.
Really?
So that's like happy coincidence that's like found art almost. It's like very kind of like Matisse, like, oh, that's handy. It worked out well. And with Cheers, I love how the sort of like the tintypes, they sync up with the personality of each of the people, but they're not actual depictions of them. So you see the saucy waitress, right?
Right.
Who always has a ready quip in Carla. You see kind of like the smug looking guy with his beer, like Klavan, like, oh, I'll tell you something brilliant you didn't know before. And you see kind of like that naive, innocent person who's that right-hand bartender's man and coach. And they always seem like so artful to me. Like when I first saw that when I was a kid, I thought, I wasn't thinking in terms of budget or anything, but I just thought someone has lavished some concern and some affection and some thought and some care. And you do not see this like at the beginning of Mr. Belvedere. Like they just go right into it. So it's different.
Two of the best shows of all time, both based in New England and remarkably, both making their debut in the fall of 1982. Cheers and Newhart. Colin, always a great talk with you. We were talking about this the other day. You are, I'm not just saying this because you're here, you are the absolute perfect guest on our weird little show because you love all the things we love, and we love that your talents and your interests are so very diverse, and that's why we always enjoy having you back on with us.
Oh, thank you. I wish more people thought to pair up sports and art and didn't think that they were antithetical, which seems to usually be the case.
Well, we've got some good conversations with you coming up, and just to tease them a little bit in the weeks ahead, we'll talk about some of the great forgotten teams in Boston sports history and an artist that not everybody knows, but if you love music, you ought to learn more about.
Yes, the two teams that I would say are the most offensively balanced teams that we perhaps have in our Boston sports history, and they are not teams that people usually ever talk about. We think about Red Sox teams that didn't quite get there with great offenses, and the 1978 team, and the 03 team, and the 1949 team even, if you want to go back that far. But the 1977 team was absolutely stacked. and ditto the 76-78 Bruins, 77-78 rather, who post Esposito had seemingly everyone on the roster pot at least 20 goals. And then on the music side of things, we have the great Arthur Alexander, R&B legend, who I wish more people knew about. If you know him, you're probably a Beatles or a Rolling Stones fan because they covered his material. But he was the blackest, baddest, most authentic, most moving, most heartfelt, virtuosic rhythm and blues, frankly, that I have ever heard. As real deal as it gets. And he just had his comeback album reissued, so that was pretty notable.
Well, we look forward to talking with you about both of those over the course of the next couple weeks. Colin, thanks as always, and we'll do it again very soon.
All right, great. Thanks a lot.
It's Colin Fleming here on Downtown.